social emotional learning has to be the rooted foundation on which we build everything else.
It's not a form you fill out. It's not a list you check, man. It's really creating something that works for the community that you're in.
SEL to me really boils down to relationships between myself and the students, between the students and the other students in the room. It all comes down to connection and community.
Whether you're 2 or 102, social emotional learning is with you your entire life. And it's something that we're continually nurturing and evolving as humans.
How are educators implementing SEL? I'm Emily Brookhart, and this is episode 2 of The Power of SEL, where we explore social and emotional learning, otherwise known as SEL, and how it relates to well-being and academic achievement. This podcast is brought to you by Education First in partnership with Novo Foundation. In episode 1, we heard from educators in multiple school districts across different regions of the United States who helped us understand what social and emotional learning actually means and why it is an essential part of how students learn. In this episode, we are going to build on what we now know about SEL toward understanding SEL practices in our education system. How are educators implementing SEL? We talked to a teacher, a principal, and 2 district-level educators, each of whom have over a decade's worth of education experience, to learn what has worked for them, their students, and their communities. Let's begin today's SEL journey by meeting the educators and district folks who we'll learn from throughout the episode about what goes into SEL implementation. We'll start with Katie Raymond, a teacher in Texas.
My name is Katie Raymond. I work at Anderson High School in Austin, Texas. As an English teacher, this year I teach 10th and 12th grade on-level English. I'm also our ELA instructional coach and our campus SEL CP&I facilitator. I got involved in SEL about 6 years ago. We have a campus-wide program that I run, as well as a lot of professional development opportunities and just every day in my classroom. I love working with teenagers because they're just like the best and the worst. Like, you get so many ups and so many downs. But that being said, they are not super comfortable being quote unquote touchy-feely, as we sometimes align with SEL. Until I started learning about how it was reframed through more of an equity lens, reframing it that way helped me vocalize that to my students and saying, you know, by becoming self-aware, by becoming able to manage yourself and become more empathetic and more action oriented towards helping marginalized groups, or, you know, that's how you make global change. And I think all students, but high schoolers specifically, they really care about those things more than people give them credit for.
Let's move from Katie, a teacher in Texas, to a former principal in California of a high school in Los Angeles, and how he came to SEL.
My name is Jeff Austin, and I am currently an independent contractor coaching schools for a few different nonprofit organizations. Before that, I served as the principal of the Social Justice Humanitas Academy, which is a pilot school, high school in Los Angeles, part of the Los Angeles Unified School District. And I was actually on the team that helped create and design and open the school in 2011 when I was a social studies teacher. So I was at the school for 12 years before leaving to do this new work. Poverty or broken relationships at home or broken relationships with their friends or drug use or divorce, those specific things, your students can't leave at the door. And I don't know that we as adults really have the capacity to do that either, but hopefully over time we develop that. So I think for me specifically, it was seeing a student in a room, they were physically there, but not maybe mentally there and emotionally there.
Moving to the district level, Trish Schaefer has been working to implement SEL for over a decade in Nevada.
My name is Trish Schaefer, and I oversee multi-tiered system of supports, restorative practices, social emotional learning, and behavioral health and management for Washoe County School District, which we have currently about 63,000 students. Our district is roughly the size of Connecticut, which is a factor in how we're able to service our students, where our geographic footprint is quite large. In 2010, our graduation rate was below 70. It was around 62%, actually.
could we systemically implement social emotional learning in an urban school district? And prior to that, it had been done well in pockets of urban districts or in smaller school districts or within schools, but true systemic implementation in an urban district was a relatively new concept at that time. But there was compelling evidence that when implemented well, students performed better on academic achievement tests, that behaviors decreased, attendance increased, all those markers that all educators are sort of endlessly hoping for, right? Like we're always on the search of how can we improve, and social emotional learning really checked all the boxes. And so looking at how could we do better, and graduation is the North Star for every school district. So that was a giant catalyst for us.
In Sacramento, California, we have Mai C. Lee, who talked to us about how SEL should be integrated not only with academics in the classroom, but SEL practices should also go all the way up to the district boardroom.
My name is Mai C. Lee, and I currently serve as the Social Emotional Learning Director for the Sacramento County Office of Education here in Sacramento, California. And I've been an educator for 26 plus years, just really working in public education and supporting the pre-K-12 sectors, and have been a huge champion of the social emotional learning work as a pedagogical approach to really supporting climate and culture, and in the way that we shift our paradigm around public education and thinking about ways that we enact on the promise of equity and democracy. This work is not a response to crises. If we are thinking about educational equity and quality of access, we have to also be thinking about how our young people are connecting to content, to people. Are they seeing themselves in the learning, in the content, in the conditions that we are priming our classroom in our school buildings in our district systems with? Does the curriculum, for example, reflect the lived experiences of our very diverse student body? Social emotional learning doesn't live just with young people or in the classroom or with school building leaders or teachers. It's actually a systemic process of engagement. When we think about social emotional learning and system-wide implementation, it is from the boardroom all the way down to the classroom.
There is an important point that Mai C. just said, that SEL must reflect the lived experiences of your students. Essentially, SEL must be equitable. And we'll dive deeper into that central theme of SEL later on in this episode. But for now, let's dive into the first step. Mai C. said that SEL is not a response to a crisis. SEL is a way of operating that lives in every aspect of the school day. But creating an SEL culture doesn't just happen overnight. SEL implementation needs to start with the adults in the building. Let's hear from Trish Schaefer about getting administrators and other educators on board.
When we first began implementing social emotional learning, so taking you back to spring 2012, fall 2012, 2013 school year, one, we had to really help people understand what social emotional learning was and what it looked like in our classrooms. Folks were very on board, but then they said, well, what is it though? How does it look? Because prior to our partnership with Novo Foundation and Castle, mostly our school counselors owned social emotional learning, and there was little flakes of glitter and rainbows and holding hands and unicorns sort of surrounding the term social emotional learning. So I would say that was an initial barrier.
And for Mai C. Lee, it has taken years to help the members of her educational community in Sacramento to understand and take ownership of all SEL has to offer.
What we learned very quickly is that this work is not transactional. So we needed to rethink differently. And in fact, I think one of the things that we learned at the time was that we needed to move beyond the theory of action and really focus on what it means to change systems. And what we needed to focus on were the adults and the adult mindsets, and really dedicating and allocating time and resource to cultivating what I call the mindsets and the heartsets. the head, the heart, and the hand in the way that we really move people's hearts, but also building their capacity and their bandwidth to understand and to set up processes. And then, of course, providing them with the tools and resources to enact on what we say are the foundational implementation steps in terms of building leadership team structures, right? In terms of how to communicate, how to set up professional development that is going to build the capacity of your adults in the system, as well as to move the work across your school, how to set up and really think about what it means to develop student-centered learning opportunities. So the adoption of relevant evidence-based programming that's going to really reflect your students' needs, your local context needs, right? And then also, how are we continuously thinking about data collection so that we're always thinking about systems improvement and continuous improvement?
Like Mycy Lee, Jeff Austin agrees that SEL implementation starts with helping adults in the building and in district offices adopt a mindset that understands how important SEL is.
I think the first major challenge is always going to be the adult mindset and the adult thinking around using SEL, because we are unfortunately often the gatekeeper to what enters into our schools and classrooms. So when you have adults that don't believe in it or are maybe in the struggle themselves, because, you know, the SEL pathway has to go both directions really to be effective. But if they're not willing to be vulnerable, or when you've been teaching for 20 years in a system that doesn't use it, adding an SEL component, adding a new reading strategy, adding anything, changing what you've been doing, I mean, change is difficult. So I think the first biggest challenge is, can you get the adults in the room, from the teacher in the classroom to the administrators to the counselors to district personnel, can you get the adults on board? The weakest link in the room can hurt that program. When if kids go to six teachers a day and one of them says, that stuff's all just what they told us when we opened our school, that's just esoteric and huggy touchy. One voice can really taint the recipe. So I think that's the first big challenge. And then your second is just the relationships and building with students so that they trust that you're doing this authentically. I think if you can get past the adult thing and then put the time and energy and thought into getting students on board, sometimes that's hard because there's kids that are in such a tough spot that that vulnerability is a big ask, but it gets to that point where you can feel it in the building. The building that they're in is full of trust and authenticity and safety in that sense.
Jeff Austin, as a former principal, was able to change adult mindsets in his building. Trish Schaefer, as a district leader, understands that changing adult mindsets at the district level can help the whole community get on board with SEL.
We all discovered, I think, together as we were moving through, that intentional adult social emotional learning is a thing. And that's actually where you have to start to have successful implementation. And then, similar to my sister districts across the nation, across the globe, the changes in leadership that we experience definitely pose challenges. We have been incredibly fortunate in Washoe through our systemic implementation efforts and building capacity with several folks in many different positions. District-wide, social emotional learning has remained a priority in our district. We just adopted a new strategic plan and profile of a learner in Washoe. And if you pull that up, social emotional learning is all over it. And I credit that to our community and everyone owning social emotional learning, our students, our parents, our leaders in schools, whether a teacher or a principal, our bus drivers. Everybody owns their piece of implementing social emotional learning, and we continually work to make sure that they understand how they can implement it in their position and what their responsibility is.
Now that we've heard a bit about what support systems and structures can look like in order to successfully begin SEL implementation, let's hear from practitioners about how they actually implement SEL in their classrooms, schools, and districts. As we listen, I invite you to think about your own context and how these practices could be applied to your own students. First, Trish Schaefer tells us one of the strategies that has been the most adaptable in her district.
One of the easier components of this work has been implementing the three signature practices, and it's both been one of our biggest high yield strategies that we have used as a school district, and probably the most adaptable, universally applicable components that we have used.
The three signature practices Trish Schaefer is talking about are part of the framework developed by the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, or CASEL, C-A-S-E-L. In episode one, Dr. Bladine Bartholus, who is the Senior Director of Practice at CASEL, told us about the five core competencies and four key settings that make up the SEL framework commonly known as the CASEL wheel. The three signature practices give educators opportunities to reinforce those frameworks laid out in the CASEL wheel. The first signature practice is an inclusive welcome. Dr. Bladine Bartholus explains.
If you have a staff meeting, if you have grade level team meetings, if you have morning meetings with your students, anytime you're bringing people together, the inclusive welcome is an opportunity to do just a quick activity that reminds everyone that before we do the work, we recognize the humanity that sits within this space. We recognize that you probably had a lot going on before you sat in this room today. So let's just take a moment and check in with each other. It could just be a quick check-in, or it could be the new year has started. What's a vision that you have for yourself in 2024? Let's just take a step back and recognize that we are human beings before we do anything. So that's the inclusive welcome.
The second signature practice is engaging strategies.
Then throughout our time together, there are engaging practices. And those are the practices that keep us connected to one another and keep us connected to the content as well. So they're the brain breaks. They're, again, recognizing our humanity. We might need a break from what we've been doing. It just reminds us that, you know, we've got opportunities to connect with one another. Maybe we're sitting in a classroom and we've gone about 30 minutes talking about content. Now we want to turn and talk with one another and talk about how does this really connect? How are we centering the content that we're actually taking in? In a training with adults, you might be doing a training on equity, and then you take a pause and really think about, how am I reflecting on what has just happened in our training? How can we talk about what we've just learned together? How do we take this information and make it something concrete for the two of us? That's an engaging practice. You're actually engaging with the content in a way that's more than just this binary way or didactic way of thinking about context.
And the third signature practice is an intentional or optimistic close.
Human beings are wired for closure. Sometimes when we've been in a training, been in a setting, it helps for us to wrap it all into a nice bow. We always want closure. And so before everyone goes their separate ways, what did we get out of this time together? Let's take a moment and center around that. Maybe it's an opportunity to share gratitude. Maybe it's an opportunity to think about, what is it that I still want to know about this topic? So somebody has kind of documented that, and next time we come together, we start off from there. But it really brings us together nicely so that we're all ending and landing on kind of the same spot before we take off and go to all the different directions that we tend to go. So those are the three signature practices, and probably one of the simplest ways that you can begin to fold in SEL without a program, without a ton of money, because you already have these meetings, you already have these trainings. Just center humanity in easy ways. And we have a resource on the school guide, schoolguide.castle.org, where people can just download it. And there's a ton of activities for each of those practices. You don't even have to think about it.
CASEL's three signature SEL practices, an inclusive welcome, engaging strategies, and an optimistic or intentional close, are used on a daily basis by Trish Schaefer and her administrative team in Nevada.
If you come to Washoe County School District and you came into a meeting led by our superintendent, you would
be greeted with an inclusive, welcoming activity. You would see a closer on the agenda. If you came to an administrator's meeting, you would see that. If you walked into a classroom, you would see the three signature practices being utilized. It is definitely where I recommend school districts start. If they're asking and beginning this journey, the three signature practices helps build community. It helps adults understand the importance of social emotional learning because they're experiencing it. It's also something that our classroom teachers understand and can get behind in terms of their scheduling. They don't have to have a certificate or a degree in social emotional learning. They don't feel like it's taking away time. They see how when there's intention, they are learning more about their students. Their students are more engaged. They're more likely to take academic risk. They're learning new critical skills like collaborative problem solving, active listening, turn-taking, right? Reciprocation. So I would say that is one of the easiest things. And you see huge impact almost immediately when you use it consistently.
One voice we heard in episode one was Alhassan Suso, a teacher in the Bronx, New York. Before he was even aware of SEL as a framework, he was already doing his own version of welcome and inclusion practices with his students by beginning every class period with affirmations.
Why affirmations? Because it is important that the things we say to ourselves usually become our reality. And secondly, I don't know what those young people are coming into my classroom with. I therefore try to do all I can to set a positive tone right at the get-go. So by starting with affirmation, I'm able to create a positive learning environment for them, whereby whatever they are coming in with, at least this process helps to shift their mindset in terms of what this hour would look like for them. And then at the end of the lesson, I do what is called a closing circle, where the kids all stand in a circle and I give them a few sentence starters. And a few of those are, I appreciate, I am grateful, I learned that, I was moved by, oh, I am sorry about. So for example, a kid can say, well, I'm sorry that I came to class late today. I know it had impacted some aspects of the lesson. Or I appreciate what student X said because it helped me deepen my understanding of the topic. Or some will say, Mr. Alhassan, I'm grateful that you are guiding us in learning these new ideas or concepts, and we are thankful to have you as our teacher.
In addition to incorporating the three signature practices into daily lessons and staff meeting, Katie Raymond's school in Texas is also providing dedicated social and emotional learning activities during sessions they call advisory time.
It's like a homeroom, and it's twice a week, and we do explicit SEL lessons. While not everyone participates, I think so many teachers naturally implement SEL that now it's not unusual to ask a student how they're feeling when they walk in the class, or on a scale of 0 to 5, how stressed are you? Please do this reflection or give me some feedback. Whereas I think 15, 20 years ago, kids would be like, what? Like, what do you want me to do? But it all comes down to the language you use and how it's framed, how it's presented to both adults and students.
For many experienced teachers like Katie Raymond, SEL provides context for why students' classwork is relevant to their personal lives outside of the classroom.
You have to teach the students. You're not teaching the content. Whatever your lesson is, it's just so important to give them those skills and to show them what you're giving them. I don't think it needs to be a secret. While we're doing this team building lesson, it's not so much about understanding this specific poem as it is about collaborating and holding space for multiple opinions and things like that. Like anything in my classroom, it's very much like, here's why we're doing this lesson. Here's why we're doing this skill. Think about your job. Don't you think your boss wants you to be able to manage your time? Or don't you think the world needs voters who are politically motivated to help other people? And they really respond well to that, I think.
Poet Maya Angelou says, "I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel." Besides that sense of belonging teachers like Katie Raymond are offering, SEL can also provide a sense of empowerment, which goes beyond the state-mandated curriculum. Jeff Austin School in Los Angeles started a peer mentoring program, which also empowered students to support and lead younger members of their own school community.
one of the other teachers who was our first principal, eventually Jose Navarro, he started this peer mentor idea. It always gave us two really good outcomes. And the first outcome is relatively obvious in that you have teenagers who, no matter how much work you put into building relationships, there's always a certain level of distrust of adults. And that always that fear that something they'll say will get them in trouble, that kind of thing. And the other side of it is we ended up with this group of, you know, 35 to 40 incredible leaders. And these weren't like our straight A students always. We had some kids that they were peer mentors, but we had to push and pull them to graduation. But they were hustlers, you know, they were survivors, and that's what they brought to the table. So it really started with that idea of providing another line of support for struggling students.
This program started as a way to support students who were struggling, but it also ended up being transformational for the mentors themselves.
I think what we did a lot differently was we gave them a lot more responsibility. They did a training with the school psychologist. We did training and releases with them so that they had some more access to sort of semi-confidential information to an extent. We considered them and told them we considered them mandated reporters for abuse. They told that to all their mentees, you know, if you tell me that you're going to hurt someone or yourself, like I'm going to report it. We gave them an incredible amount of responsibility. And I think that gave us more results from both outcomes. They became much more responsible leaders. And it comes from the relationship. The end of ninth grade year, the ninth grade teachers make a list of ninth grade, you know, that'll be 10th grade mentees the following year. And then we have 11th grade mentees. And then the 12th graders get the full scope. But it takes building the relationship to really know who is or is not going to be able to handle that responsibility. And it's crazy to think. When I say we have 35 to 40 senior mentors, that means about a third of the senior class are mentors. That's one out of three kids. That's kind of the result that we get is we just have that many students who have that capacity once they reach that senior year. Rarely do we ask someone to leave the program. And every once in a while, a student says, like, I need to leave because I can't maintain it. So that's really how it works. They have a class, they have a teacher. And that they go through this constant work and reflection and documenting their conversations and meeting with mentees.
Many schools across the country find success in running peer mentor programs built on social and emotional learning frameworks. And like with Jeff Austin's school, the long-term rewards go beyond what they could have imagined when the programs began and end up leading to even more innovation.
Another fun tool we do, I don't know anybody else that we call them VIP meetings. And when a student is struggling, we will have a meeting that includes the student, hopefully both parents. Sometimes they'll bring in like an older sibling, every single teacher, their counselor. And we always check with the student first. I would say more than half of them, their mentor will come in. It always starts with, here's what I really appreciate about the student. And everyone has to do it. And the teachers get really good at it. The parents, the family members struggle almost every time. Mijo, I love you. I love you. But sometimes you're a pain and it's like, no. I love you because it's hard. And that's only the second hardest part. The hardest one is the kid. The kid has to say what they appreciate about themselves. So we do that a round of that. And then a round of what are your hopes for the student? And then a round of what is my role? What is my responsibility? Grades, behaviors, those specific things are not in the conversation. They know why they're there, but they need to feel appreciation, hope, and action and love. And that's what that meeting provides. And having a peer mentor in there who's like, someone you see walking around the halls with you and they're struggling too, and have them say, hey, I really like when I see you, when we meet, you always smile and say, thank you for meeting with me. Or, you know, I really hope that after I graduate that you maybe become a mentor and that you can help other people. So the peer mentor program, the VIP meetings, I mean, those are just really strong programs.
Tina Vasquez is a teacher in Charlottesville, Virginia, who you'll hear more from in the next episode of this series. Let's hear today about the amazing program she started that incorporates the physical environment into her SEL practice with her students, many of whom are newcomers to the country and English learners.
I've been exploring a lot more recently outdoors, outdoor spaces. We have an outdoor classroom. We have woods near the school. I piloted a project in the spring with my newcomers. I worked with someone who did nature-based learning, and we kind of created this curriculum because a lot of either their typical nature-based learning activities required a higher level of instruction or dialogue or conversation. And sometimes our SEL activities, when they're designed as activities, involve a lot of language. But looking at how we can access the benefits with very few words, we did some activities going out in the woods. We were starting just with observing. We were looking for small changes in the trees and the plants or the creek. We did some work learning about a few animals that are native to the area and tracking.
Tina's story is a beautiful example of how finding ways to get students outside the classroom, whenever possible, can support their social and emotional learning. We've heard similar stories from countless educators who have seen many benefits both for their students and for themselves when they were able to be outside of the physical school environment and incorporate some form of nature or travel into learning.
The biggest benefits I saw were being in that space and having an activity that grounded students in their senses. You could just see the calming effect. Even the ones who are really kind of anxious and rattled, like just the nervous system's calming and dropping into their senses and moving more slowly. And those little sparks of wonder that were contagious amongst them. The program absolutely met our goals of finding activities there that would help students access a way to feel safe anywhere where they are. And that we're thinking, okay, if you have ways to interact with nature, like wherever you are, whatever is going on, you have this in your tool belt that you can go outside with some trees and you can do some of those things to notice the different colors or to look for tracks or that kind of thing, or practicing something called sit spot, where you just sit in a spot for a little while and you're just quiet and observing, and you don't have to do anything with that information. We had journals where they could draw, and sometimes we would share out experiences, but it was not required. Ironically, not requiring language ended up, after several sessions, leading to a lot more language, because there was more sharing around the drawings and wanting to explain them and what they saw and what is the word, you know, for this and how do you say this, and more talking between them and just in partners and in the group.
Hopefully these examples of successfully implemented SEL programs will help spark some ideas for implementing SEL in your own school or district. And how can we make sure that the needs of our unique communities are actually being met through these SEL programs we are developing? Jeff Austin talked to us about how he approached SEL with a lens of inclusivity and authenticity when he was a principal in Los Angeles.
You really need to make sure that you're building a program that is inclusive of all the voices. And so you're hearing in your classroom, at your school, in your district, what are the specific needs facing that community, the community that you're a part of? Being inclusive gives you that relevance. Talking about the challenges of living in overcrowded housing isn't going to be an important topic if you are dealing with rural schools, right? So being inclusive, I think, is your first part, because that inclusivity will give you some relevance. And then I think from there, I would say make sure that you are embedding your SEL within all parts of your school day. It should be part of your instruction. It should be part of your curriculum. It should be a foundational piece of your school culture. Even when you get into talking about student behavior and discipline, all of it has to really mix into all parts of your work. And I think that, again, goes back to creating that level of authenticity. Because you are with students so long during a day, there's not a moment where it's like, hey, right now we're doing physics, we're not doing SEL. It's like, no, like you just never know when something comes up. It is a component of learning.
Jeff Austin is talking about equity. What is equity and why is it important? Not all students experience academic and social and emotional learning in the same way. Research shows that differences in the learning experiences of students, as well as their outcomes, are related to their socioeconomic status, race, gender, zip code, home language, disability status, and several other factors. As a result, there needs to be an intentionality behind designing SEL to support all students. And this is where equity comes in. Castle, for example, uses the term transformational SEL. Transformational SEL is an approach to SEL that facilitates critical examination of individual and contextual factors that contribute to inequities, and collaborative solutions that lead to personal, community, and societal well-being. We'll speak more about this in episode 3, but we believe that SEL cannot be fully successful unless it takes into account cultural competency, a recognition and incorporation of students' cultural values, practices, and assets. Katie Raymond serves as a CP&I facilitator in her Texas school district.
CP&I stands for Cultural Proficiency and Inclusivity. We talked a lot about how the equity lens and that cultural proficiency ties in with SEL, and you can't have one without the other. While SEL used to be the end game, or at least that was the perspective I had, now equity is the end game. SEL is one of the tools to get there, along with cultural proficiency, along with sense of belonging, along with financial support, and all those things that tie together.
From a teacher's perspective to a district-wide lens, Trish Schaefer at the Washoe County School District works toward the long-term goal of prioritizing equity through SEL frameworks. And similar to how the Austin School District uses their own terms to highlight their focus on cultural proficiency, Washoe County sometimes uses the term social employability learning in place of SEL.
Equity is always a factor nationally, and Washoe County School District is no different. For our district, we have really taken care and worked closely with our Department of Family School Partnerships to make sure that the language we are using, the way we are describing it, is unifying. We also looked at other languages and some of the terminology that we use to make sure that when we're speaking about social emotional learning and we have interpreters, that what we want to say, the message that we are trying to deliver, is the message that is indeed delivered, because some of our words that we use don't translate.
I see Lee in Sacramento, California. Equity includes letting those who are the most proximate to the problem be the leaders of their own learning.
When we think about democracy, it's about civic engagement, right? It's about people feeling like they have a voice in the process, folks feeling like they have a sense of agency to move change, to be a part of the movement that is going to shift and shape the way that we're governed. For young people and for our educators, it's also feeling a sense of agency, in a sense that my voice matters every day that I engage in my educational journey, in my educational experience. For our educators, that they are also cared for, that their voices matter, that they are attended to by this institution that we call public education, that from the minute they walk into a classroom building, their leaders, their school principals, their folks who are charged with taking care of the people in that building, care for them, so that they can in turn feel that sense as they walk into their classroom spaces, to also pass on that sense of care and sense of community and sense of connection and cultivating sense of belonging for all of their folks. It really does start, I think, at the very, very top.
The sense of belonging that comes from SEL founded in equity is not the only consideration when implementing new practices. Developing the unifying language, then getting educators, students, and parents on board, on top of all of the training required for educators to be successful as they serve their students, it all takes time. And being adaptable throughout this ongoing growth process is also a must, as circumstances continue to change every semester in our schools, our communities, our states, and our country.
Nothing about this is really easy because it is such adaptive work. It's stuff that you can't put into a template per se. You have to be ready to constantly make adjustments. I think maintaining is relatively easy if you get the adaptive part right and if you are doing authentic work. So your students really need to believe that this SEL work and talking about managing feelings and emotions and challenges and those things, they need to believe that it really does matter to the adults in the room. And I think when you're then kind of looking to then build, to scale it up a little bit, then the challenge goes back to the adult component. If you're adding staff, adding teachers, adding partners, making sure that that universal authenticity stays in place is super important. Incorporating it into all of your hiring, from teachers to admin to counselors to your office staff to your custodial staff, everyone has to have some level of understanding of it. The authenticity gives you that space to be adaptive and to change to what the situation is in front of you. And I think when you get into that question of, I feel like SEL takes away from the time, you know, if you're in a 360-minute school day, I'd rather be running at 75% for 300 minutes than running at 50% for 360. Because in the end, if you're adding up the actual efficiency of the minutes, you're getting more time back if you measure time, not by its passing, but by its use.
Providing teachers with training in SEL is really important too.
We always did a lot with, people called them restorative circles or council. That was a big component tool at our school. And it really meant that we needed to train people how to ask the questions in the right way, to build circles of trust, how to get to the tough issues, how to word them, how to manage, you know, all the discomfort that comes with being vulnerable, and practice. As a staff, we did our own councils within staff. Because we did a good job hiring people who believed in it, our staff councils were emotional. We were sometimes kind of a mess. So I think getting people training and practice, because in any teaching, you don't want your first draft to be what you present to students. And then kind of, again, adaptive. Be ready to adjust to the crisis that happens in the community, adjust to, you know, the pandemics and the shootings and the fires and the homelessness, or, you know, whatever the thing that happens. Be adaptive, be reflective, use the data in front of you, use the real quantitative stuff. You can look at how your attendance and grades are going, but also look at the qualitative, look at the stories you're hearing, who's out, what are they talking about? So those are my big ones, just inclusive to create relevance, embed it in everything, train, practice, be adaptive. And I hopefully avoided putting anything too much in a box, because it's not a form you fill out. It's not a list you check, man. It's really creating something that works for the community that you're in.
While principals like Jeff Austin lead their school staff towards success through training, being inclusive, and adapting to constant change, district leaders like Trish Schaefer are doing what they can to support their schools by also understanding this need for time, flexibility, and for adult SEL.
It's okay if you take a year to 3 years, just helping people understand what is social emotional learning, why is it so important, and what does it look like in a school community for your adults, both staff and families, and your students. Go slow to go fast, so to speak, and absolutely making sure that people understand what it is, what it looks like, and why it's so important. And then after that, start with your adults and spend a year or two working with your adults.
Mai C. Lee shared a similar sentiment.
Returning to that adult SEL, it was really important that we dedicate sufficient time. And I would say that originally we didn't do a good job because we treated it like what we do in education, which is that there are these steps to getting things done, to implementing system-wide practices. What we learned about the implementation of social emotional learning is that it's not a linear process. It's actually a very dynamic process. And again, it starts with prioritizing people, honoring the fact that human beings have tremendous knowledge and skills and abilities, and they come to these spaces that we call school systems with their own lived experiences. So how do we also leverage that? How do we also leverage the fact that a lot of our schools are doing some great SEL work? They may not call it social emotional learning, but how do we honor and acknowledge that that good work is already happening and refine and build and co-construct with our educators? And so those were some of the earlier lessons learned that were really key and critical to us.
Developing an equitable SEL plan and allowing the time and flexibility to implement the frameworks and practices that address the unique needs of each school can be a waste of time and effort if we don't actually know the people in that school's community and listen to what they need. And in order for us to hear those needs, all we need to do is ask our community members.
The high schools have different cultures because they're in a little bit different parts of town. The struggles are different in each community. My recommendation is if you're a district leader, provide the support and give the school the space to find the need for their community and support them in that. And if they ask for support on developing and adding tools, like support in that way. But giving like a top-down mandate to this, it's not going to be authentic. It's not going to meet the needs of that community. And it's tempting to do that, but it just isn't going to work to the level you really need it to work. It'll work on paper. We had our little buttons, man, that said restorative justice, but it doesn't mean we were doing it.
The work to find out what your school communities need shouldn't just be on educators and school administrators. From my C. Lee, that community engagement is also the responsibility of school district leadership.
I think it's about building the infrastructure to enable the work to continue. And also it's about the intentionality. Being clear about your vision and co-constructing the vision with the folks that you're engaging with, inviting voices for whom this work is for. So our young people and our parents and our community partners, as well as our educators who are carrying on the work in their classrooms and their schools. But the intentionality of how we're positioning this work as a lever for equity and access, as a lever for democracy, as a lever for systems transformation, and as a lever to move academic progress.
Here's Trish Schaefer again.
Parents are the most important humans in a child's life, and they are our strongest partners as educators. So working closely with them to first and foremost listen to their experiences around social emotional competence, and particularly post COVID, how are they and how are their children doing with their well-being? How are they connecting with others and themselves, understanding how to manage the emotions that they may be experiencing, how to set and achieve goals, all of that. It is imperative that we partner with our parents and help them have access to the same information that we would share with our educators. What is social emotional learning? Why is it important? And what does it look like?
If there is anything you take away from today's episode, my hope is that you've seen that there are so many pathways to start doing SEL and so many different ways it can look. It can be one enthusiastic and dedicated teacher in a district, or it can be an SEL-driven district team that creates buy-in from all of its educators. The best way to do SEL is whatever way that works for you and your students, and you and your students are the best determiners of that. You are the true experts. But don't take my word for it. Let's hear some parting advice from today's educators. Here's Dr. Bladeen Bartholus, Katie Raymond, Trish Schaefer, and Mycee Lee.
The most important and most valuable SEL lesson that you can give is the SEL lesson that you are. I always quote this by James Baldwin because I think it's just very powerful. And he said, "Children have never been good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to emulate them." Whether you're a tenured 30 years in, just starting, what you can always manage is the way that you show up and what you put in front of young people.
It's so hopeful to be in a space with, I don't want to say like-minded people, but people who are looking towards the same goal, even if it's really, really far away, to know we're all stepping, dragging our heels through the mud towards it together. It's a long walk alone, so it's nice to have other people there.
I think the best advice that I can give anybody is to continue to stay the course. There will be changes in our political landscape. There will be changes in the landscape of your school district. There are going to be changes in the landscape of your resources. But continue to lean in. And when you feel like you don't want to anymore, or there are roadblocks put in front of you, I would say lean on the SEL community. So advocate for yourself and reach out to others. There's a wealth of resources out there.
If we're only about the academic content and we're only about setting metrics and benchmarks for ELA, for math, and we dismiss or ignore the fluidity of relationships, the beauty of connections, and the importance of cultivating a sense of belonging, we will have missed opportunities to connect, to strengthen the ways in which we support all of our human beings, our young people, as well as our adults, to thrive. And right now, we are in survival mode. So how we get to thriving is that connected glue, that connected tissue of social emotional learning.
The Power of SEL is brought to you by Novo Foundation, Education First, and Big Duck. Special thanks to our expert guests, Jeff Austin, Dr. Bladine Barthelis, Mycy Lee, Katie Raymond, Trish Schaefer, Alison Suso, and Tina Vasquez. Our Education First production and writing team is Chad Rubicaba, Brinny Ramsey, Fatima Omar, and Aaron Papelka. From Big Duck, strategic guidance is by Farah Trumpeter, artwork design by Claire Taylor Hansen, copywriting by Nicole Tufts, project management by Brenda Perez, and writing, recording, editing, and sound design by Marcus DePaula. Music is by Cody Martin. This podcast is made possible because of the work of the SEL in Action Fund grantees, who you can learn more about at thepowerofsel.org. If you liked The Power of SEL, please recommend it to a friend or rate and review it on your favorite podcast app. I'm Emily Brookhart. Thank you for joining us on this journey of exploring well-being and academic achievement through social and emotional learning on The Power of SEL. Join us next time for episode 3, where we'll be looking at the many misconceptions about SEL, whether there is any truth to them, and how to navigate your way around them.